Good morning, and thank you very much for the opportunity. Like any good title, the title is really just a lie. This is what I promised to do. And what I'll actually do is, the tradition in my family is to tell you a story that hopefully will have some interesting points and some people and some landmark mathematics and science up through about 1990. And then that should be maybe about 40 minutes if my count goes well. And then in the last 20 minutes, I would like to tell you about a couple of things that I believe should be of interest to you as you look ahead in considering knotted fields. So in the one bit will be a paper we just published last week, and another bit is a paper we will perhaps publish sometime in the future. It's ongoing research. So this is all going to be very sort of, impressionistic. So you need to keep it, I'm not going to worry so much about the details. I'm going to tell you the story about why, when, and how. So the origins of knotting and linking and entanglement, of course, in my mind go back very, very far. So that would be the first part. Then a bit of the history that we've seen already multiple times. What can I say? This is how I prepared it, and so did everyone else. So we're going to go swimming through that. And then I will talk about the Vaughan-Jones era. And ironically, Vaughan is just on the other side of the wall, along with Mike and friends. And I'll tell you sort of some of the consequences of his discoveries. And then in the last bit, I'll tell you a bit about some of the interests I have in applications to the natural sciences, particularly biology. So not I wish I could, this room were big enough I could read my own slides. So knotting goes back a long way in history, and there are lots of entertaining things that you've all no doubt have seen. The hagfish is one of my favorites that ties itself in knots. For various reasons. I always thought it was an absolutely wonderful fish, but now people who actually know personally, have had personal interaction with hagfish, tell me it's a slimy, disgusting creature. Nevertheless, it does like trefoil, so it's got to be a friend of mine. And also, if you hang out in vineyards, as I often do, you will see that entanglement happens very much in plants as well. So I will end up with sort of the nano knotting in protein structures and in DNA. So across all the scales, you observe knotting. Here's probably the oldest evidence of knotting I could actually find, because knots occur in material and fibers, and they tend to sort of deteriorate. And so here is some remnants of knots made out of some nettle fibers about 10,000 years ago in Finland. And of course, there's the artistic side, and that's a whole other story. Knots appear in icons throughout human history. And of course, thinking of Renzo, I was thinking of very large scales and knots and solar storms and so on as a concept he introduced to me many years ago. And here's a rather recent picture of a rather significant solar storm that you can find on the internet. So, for the mathematicians, people will say that knots in the study of knotting began with Vandermonde, but I think that really, in terms of being mentioned in his notes, in his notebooks, but for most of us, it really sort of began in real seriousness with the formula for linking due to Gauss that grew out of his study of astronomy, the solar system, and his efforts to predict trajectories of bodies moving in astronomy. That was his first real application of dynamics to be able to predict where one would next sight a particular body that for which he had like three pieces of data. And then some 20 years later or so, this linking number became a tool that he used, he and maybe some of his colleagues, to try to determine which astronomical bodies actually had linked orbits. I seem to remember some 22 of them were identified as having orbits that were actually linked. I remember my history. Then, as we know, went on to the study and interest of Kelvin, and as we saw the other day, with knotted smoke rings. And so, in my reading, the simplest was, let's see, I wrote it down here someplace because I can never remember it. Okay, trefoil oxygen was the unknot. The trefoil was carbon. Oh, yes. And the hop link was to be sodium for some reason, at least in what I found. And so it wasn't just knots that were of interest. It was knots and links. The quality of knots for a topologist, for a real topologist, means that you have a closed curve and you're allowed to deform them in order to see whether two configurations can be superimposed. We typically look at prime knots, so we're interested in connected sums which can decompose a knot into irreducible pieces. But trying to enumerate knots, trying to identify which knots are the same, is a rather difficult enterprise. And so here are two of my favorite pictures. Not two, I have lots of favorite pictures. It's like children, what can I say? Anyway, these are two pictures, and you'll notice that they're presentations of knots, and they're exactly the same except for one little crossing right here and right here. And trying to identify which knots those were turns out to be a rather difficult task. You're no doubt trying to do this as we look at them. You should be if you're a curious person. And I will tell you that one is a trefoil knot and the other is an unknot. But which is which?
Right-hand side is unknotted.
The right-hand side is unknotted. Okay, let me just check. No.
No.
I should have had the vote. Now that I've given away the answer, it's no fair. But you're wrong, and that is typically the case, even among topologists. Right? You are exactly like all of us. It turns out this is the unknot. Okay. Also, whether or not, how to say it, if you can construct knots, that's also a hard problem. And I'm interested in knots that are modeled by polygons in space. So I'm pretending I have linear edges attached at nodes, and these edges are all of the same length. And the question really is, how many different knots can you construct with how many number of sticks? So this has 8 sticks, and this is a knot for which we couldn't decide for the longest time whether or not it existed. In fact, one of my students, Jorge Calvo, was living here over in sitting in his apartments with a graduate student in sociology, and the student in sociology asked him, Jorge, what are you doing? And Jorge pointed to this configuration he made out of pieces of rubber tube and tinker toys, and he said, I'm trying to decide whether that knot exists. And of course the graduate student in sociology was very concerned about him at that case, because evidently it exists. But in fact, it didn't exist with 8 sticks. It's 818. This one, however, does exist, and there it is. And how you find such things, that's the tough question. How you determine such, whether or not something like this exists. Also, then, to make life easier, in some sense, you might make the system simpler. So you might look at the simple cubic lattice. And here is the simplest knot that we all know. It has 24 edges. Constructed by Yunnan Diao quite a few years ago. But determining which knots can be constructed and what their properties are, and if you do this sort of in some random way, what proportion of configurations will be unknotted or knotted and so on, is a very, very difficult problem for which, at least in my mind, we don't really have the mathematical technology to be able to resolve. So, we look at projections.
Can you go back to that?
Sure.
I mean, if I voxelize space, I would say I could put any knot in the voxel. So what's
number of fix the number of edges?
Oh, I have to fix the number of edges.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So as a function of the number of edges, which knots can you make? As the number of edges increases, you can clearly make more, but both here and here, we basically don't have a clue how to really count the topology, the different topologies. Okay, so just determining whether or not two knots are equal or not is a tough problem given their projections. And so that was the kind of enterprise we were all engaged in, and applications to the study of three-dimensional manifolds. It's a theorem of Liquorice and Wallace going back to probably 1963 or two that says that every three-dimensional manifold can be constructed by looking at a link in three space, hollowing out a tube around each of the components and sewing it back in again in some other way. So it's a sort of surgery theory. So this is fundamentally very important to us trying to sort of study three-dimensional manifolds. Fortunately, in 1926, well, fortunately, it's a bit of a myth, because although this theorem due to Reitemeister is very simple to prove, in fact, turns out to be not nearly so useful. If you're looking at diagrams, these three diagrams describe all the possible changes in the planar pictures with the crossings encoded that you need in order to determine whether two knots or two lengths are topologically equivalent. So these are the famous Reitemeister moves that will come back a number of times in my discussion. So it's not so easy to see whether two knot projections or presentations are the same or not. And in fact, it's a provable hard problem. Let me put it that way. Oops, wrong button. So of course we started with the unknot, trying to recognize that, not so clear that we know how to do that. The trefoil knot, figure eight knot, or Listing's knot, reminds me of Jim Van Buskirk. Tell you a story about Jim. For those who don't know Jim, he's a mathematical brother of mine, and he came into my office one day here at Santa Barbara where he was visiting and showed me a table of knots and on one sheet. And he says, Ken, I said, well, Rob, you know what this is? And I looked at it, and I said, well, it looks like a table of knots. He said, well, no. It's a knot table, knot listing, listing's knot. and so, whoops. It is a knot table, knot listing, listing's knot. This is Listing's knot. And so used Listing. Anyway, I still have it in my office. It's one of my prized possessions. But here is a more modern knot table with images due to Rob Schirein. And in it, you'll notice we've got, we've got sort of large numbers, 8 sub 4. That just happens to be the fourth knot, fourth prime knot that occurs in the table ordered in not in a totally decided way. The first knots we know, depending on whether your number is even or odd. But then after a while, they get so complicated that the organization is a little uncertain. There's some sort of historical accidents that are of interest, but basically that's it. Here's two-component link. Someplace there's the three-component link. No crossings, no linking. And then things get more complicated, sort of encoded by the color. Alternating knots, that is where the crossings alternate as you go around, or links go around, under, over, are a very friendly class of knots or links. But unfortunately, as you get larger and larger in the number of crossings, they become more and more irrelevant. That is, the proportion of alternating knots to the the proportion of alternating knots goes to zero as sort of the number of crossings goes to infinity. The first non-alternating knots occur with 8 crossings. And they're at the end of the table because that's, of course, where you would put them if you were mostly interested in diagrams. One of the traps that happens is that you see properties that are true for the simplest knots. And the simplest knots are all alternating and are very, very nice. So you can lure yourself into believing you've discovered a theorem, a fact, because you've based it on only a little evidence through the 7 or most of the 8 crossing knots. That's a big trap that has occurred quite often in the study of knotting in sort of the physical sciences. But here's this is sort of the table that exists pretty much still, where I list on the left, where we list on the left the minimal crossing number and the number of, for example, 22 crossing knots, which are alternating, So it's sort of like 976,000, 976,000,16,485 for 22 crossings, work of a group of Canadians a few years back now. We have no idea how to fill in the non-alternating ones. We just know there are many, many more. A number of things that have been of interest are sort of small integer invariants. So the Gordian or the unknotting number just tells us how many times we have to change a crossing in order to sort of arrive at an unknot. So that's a very, I think, a fundamental kind of spatial property that has been of interest right since the very beginning. And it hasn't been, let's say, until what I would call the modern era, following the Jones era that Ludmilla will talk about, where we've been able to really get some real traction with this. In 1984, there were still 8 crossing knots whose unknotting number we didn't know. That's how tough things were in the era that I'm going to talk about.
Can you give us those problems?
Pardon? Let's see. You lost me there. What was the question, Rob? I'm not going to tell you.
No, I guess you can't.
That's the problem. Yeah, right. Bridge number is another useful way of classifying things. You hold your knot in space in the sort of nicest possible way. Nicest possible means you have the fewest number of maxima. Everything descends. It sort of looks like a braid descending. And you have 2 maxima, and of course, then 2 maxima and then 2 minima. That gives you the bridge number. Determining the bridge number is another one of those tough problems. More to the question that I was posing earlier, just describing how much material or how much stuff you need in order to construct a knot. Now that's a hard problem for which we don't have any real theory except in very special classes. And I know of teams of people still right at this very moment who are trying to address this either in the lattice or in polygonal space. Colin Adams typically has a group of students working on it, and I think he has a group working in the summer as well. So that brings me to an evolution of not just sort of the pictorial sort of Tate era, Kelvin Tate era sort of discussion, but where we try to now move ahead a little bit. We associate a crossing number, a positive crossing number, to a configuration like this negative here. And we count those numbers and use those numbers to try to characterize something about the presentation of the knot. So, I lost something here. There it is. Oh, right at the bottom. The linking number. As we've heard earlier this week, the linking number of 2 components, oriented components with a presentation, can be constructed or can be calculated just by looking at the crossings between the 2 components and adding up the plus and minus ones and dividing by 2. And that's a topological invariant. And the way you prove that, and one way to prove that if you don't want to use Gauss's formula, is to look at what happens with the Rademeister moves. Now, the first Rademeister move isn't relevant because it has to do with a crossing of a component with itself. So we ignore that. Second one, if I look at this and I have one strand oriented, let's say vertically, and the other one oriented in this fashion, I'll notice that this crossing would be negative and this one would be positive, and so they cancel out. And so when I remove them, I haven't changed anything. Okay? And here, nothing's changed. So there's the proof. Linking number is a topological invariant. So sort of checking whether things are changed or not, or how they change with regard to these Rademeister moves, is sort of a classical way of describing something that is unchanged under topological equivalence. The writhe was used by Tate and colleagues with prime knots. And they believed, but couldn't prove, that the writhe was a topological invariant of the presentation up to mirror image. But in fact, it wasn't until 1974 that a graduate student at Princeton discovered, when he tried to use all the known algebraic topology at that time to show that the knot tables were complete and were not redundant, came across the knots 10161 and 10162. And as try as he might, he couldn't show they were different. And so he did what we all did back in that era. He got two pieces of rope. He tied one, 10161 and 10162, tied them, and then shook them around and moved them around, and by God, they were the same. That's how he proved they were the same. They were the same. And the irony is, of course, they were right next, here they are, by the way. They don't look the same, right? But there they are, right next to each other in the pre-1974. So if you have one of the first edition copies of Rolfson's book on knots, you will see these two knots in there. And then in subsequent editions, they, of course, have vanished.
Okay. Was the only mistake, let's say, of Tate.
Was the only mistake, exactly.
Amazing.
Truly amazing.
But there's an algorithm to do that now. So
yes.
You don't have to just build a room.
No, there are algorithms.
I mean, I don't know if you're honest with it, but about 20 years ago, John Sullivan and I electrically charged, but with the Möbius energy, these two, mm-hmm. we floated. We got, of course, things that looked very different for the minimum, mm-hmm. but the energies are driven by Möbius transformations. And so after we put in the three sphere into moments of inertia, into one of the four possible projections along the ellipsoid of inertia, mm-hmm. they were dead on.
They were dead on, yeah. Right. So anyway,
a couple days to do
that wasn't so long ago, right? We are, well, many, as I look around the room, many of us remember 1974. Okay, so going on here.
Gerald Ford.
He was still
so more of this sort of odyssey, now getting into sort of the era where I was more intimately involved. First begins, of course, with Alexander in 1923, where he's studying the algebraic topology of the complement of the knot, and basically using homology theory and module theory and rings and so on, discoveries he has a principal ideal domain, and he has a generator for that, which turns out to be a polynomial having to do with how many times you wrap around the knot, and voila, there is the Alexander polynomial in 1923. And about 40 years later or so, John Conway gets involved, and he's looking at knot diagrams and presentations and discovers or recognizes a relationship between a knot in which you see a crossing, which is negative in this case, and positive if you've changed the crossing, or if you removed it and everything outside of this little region in these diagrams remains exactly the same. He recognizes, as you could see implicitly, if not explicitly, in Alexander's work, this relationship. This relationship is a driving force for many of us, because we realize that we know how to unknot things. For example, if you have a knot projection, you can show that by changing a less than or equal to half the number of crossings, you can make it an unknot by the following. You look at your projection on the floor, take a piece of rope, put your foot on one end, and just follow that rope around in a sort of what's essentially an ascending fashion until you come back to where you start. And you pick up that other piece, pull them two together. What you have is basically a parking ramp, where you start at the bottom, you're going up, you're going up, you're going up, you're going up, and then you go down. Well, that's an unknot, because it has one maximum, one minimum, and so if you look at that picture from the side, you see that it's just a piece of rope coiled hanging down. So that's an unknot. So we can change every knot or every link to a trivial knot or link. So by changing crossings in some cunning way, you can actually use this formula and an induction on the number of crossings to calculate any knot polynomial. Okay? That's sort of a sort of standard. It's like a double induction. First induction is on the number of crossings. Second induction is on the number of changes you have to make to realize a trivial, an unlink or a trivial knot, an unknot. And so, by the way, here is a picture of Alexander, and here's a picture of Conway, and this is not a snake, this is a necktie.
This is,
pardon?
What is that?
It's a necktie, I think.
Uh-huh.
It's, you know, I looked at it, I said, he's doing this. So John Conway, among his many amazing talents, is he likes to do knot tricks. And so here he is caught in the process of doing one of them. Anyway, so this is the relationship between Conway's version and the original Alexander's version. It's a small change of variables. Okay, so there we were. I forget the year again. 1969, right. I remember where I was. Here in Santa Barbara. Right, I came to Santa Barbara in 1969. So I was either at MIT or in transition. But anyway, this was what was happening then. And then, of course, 20 years later, more or less, Vaughn Jones, who's another, has California roots at UCLA, studying von Neumann algebras, came across presentations related to dimensions of von Neumann algebras that bore a very similar relationship to some algebraic structures associated to knots, and came up with a new knot invariant. And so it was the summer of 1984 that Ray Licorice and I were sitting in the Commons Room in Cambridge drinking tea one afternoon, and I was showing him my calculations trying to determine unknotting numbers. Big problem in 1984. We didn't know how to determine unknotting numbers. And so I was doing calculations with von Neumann algebras and Jones stuff. And I remember Raymond saying to me, well, Ken, you know what you have there. If you know Raymond, it means you don't have a clue as to what you have there. And he's about to tell you. And so he says, but Ken, you have a Conway recursion formula. I had a formula that I was using to do a calculation, very much like this double induction that I was describing, but it was now involving the Jones polynomial. So we realized that the Jones polynomial had a relationship very similar to the Conway recursion formula. And of course, got very interested in that because we knew these had to be fundamentally different. One of the big realizations that Jones made was that unlike the Alexander polynomial, when you changed, did a mirror reflection, you didn't change your polynomial. When you did it with his, you got something which was decidedly different. So you could prove, you knew that then the right-hand trefoil and the left-hand trefoil were different. Okay? So the Jones polynomial was somehow encoding really new information. This is what got us all very excited in believing that, my gosh, this might be the key. We might actually be able to do something really quite amazing, as, of course, history has shown to be the case. So, unfortunately, Raymond and I weren't the only people to realize this. Jones, there's Vaughn Jones in 1985, summer. He's a little grayer now and thinner, but here he is, and then Jim Hosty, Adrian Akinyanu, myself, Peter Freud, Raymond Licorice, and David Yetter, many of us had roughly the same ideas, and out of that came another polynomial which had two variables in it, right? Jones and Alexander had one. We said, but you know, why one? Maybe this is the tip of an iceberg. Maybe that more are possible. So, in fact, you discovered there is no necessary relationship between the two variables, that we just chose this for symmetric and how to say it. This just looks nicer. You've got a plus power associated to a plus, a minus power associated to minus, and you have another term with another variable. And just like with the Jones and Alexander polynomials, it does change when you change from a knot to its mirror image, as you see with the trefoil. Furthermore, by cunningly choosing these variables, you can get either the Jones or the Alexander polynomial, so this is strictly a generalization of both of them. So that was the summer of 1984, 85.
So I could ask this question two ways. Did L and M have geometric mean? I know they've got another meaning.
What? Longitude and meridian?
Yeah.
Or if you quote Rob Kirby, Liggett and Meyer?
That was the question.
Do L and M have any real meaning? In fact, Michael Atiyah asked us, how do you know these are really polynomials? You call them polynomials, but why are they polynomials rather than just some sort of structured collection of numbers that behaves in some curious way? How did you say? With Alexander, for sure, we knew it was a polynomial. And with Jones, for sure, we knew it was a polynomial. But when you sort of marry this, how do we know? Well, that's a good question. So we could see this was really better because we could find some knots thanks to Morwen Thistlethwaite and his amazing computer. He could tell us that, in fact, these two knots are distinguished by this Humphrey polynomial, but not by the other two. On the other hand, we can't distinguish knots that are related by mutation, where mutation means find a little region like this. We have four exits. Do a 180-degree rotation and stick it back in. These two knots are, again, also in the tables. One is known as the Conway knot, after John Conway, and the other is the Kinoshita-Terasaka knot, which was a very favorite example of us who were studying geometric topology in the 60s. These polynomials, like others that I'll describe, are unable to determine mutations because of basically there's a basis for the structure. And this basis that you associate to these structures is invariant under this kind of rotation, this kind of symmetry, which gives a challenge then as to how to distinguish between mutations. So Bob Brandt, this is a picture of Bob. He came to Santa Barbara as a master's student, a fellow I met when I was in Europe. And he and I spent a lot of time in the evening in my office wondering about these polynomials. And so he, being a young, energetic person, wanted to prove he was smarter than anybody else. So I proposed a task. Namely, we should close this polynomial, or open the polynomial in the only other way possible. Here, sort of vertically, would be what we call L0. But if you erase this and do it the other way, rather than having, if you start with a knot, rather than having a link here, you have another knot, but you've messed up the orientation. Okay, so how to deal with the orientation was something we didn't know what to do. But anyway, so Bob and I went through this hours and hours and hours of calculations, and by golly, we could have a polynomial like this, where we had an L0 and L infinity. And that got Raymond and Bob and I thinking about lots of stuff. First, we had this kind of a polynomial. Second, we realized, looking at this and doing calculations back when our laptops, you know, like had 128K memory, if we evaluated these things at roots of unity, we got interesting numbers. And so we wrote papers about these interesting numbers that came out of classical knot theory.
In 85, they weren't even laptops.
Oh yeah, right. My Macintosh sort of looked like this, and yeah.
But it had a handle.
It had a handle, right? Yeah, laptop. Thank you. Right, they were sort of portable. I could go on an airplane with them. Right.
What's the L infinity here?
The infinity. So infinity means infinity is 1/0. Of course. You know, mathematicians are always like that. You answer a question with something that's obvious and it's totally meaningless. But what it means is, in Conway's notation about the way he constructed his knots, there was a sort of zero kind of crossing and a sort of orthogonal one, which was 1/ that. So we had numerators and denominators, and so infinity made a sense in the Conway world. So anyway, we were quite amazed and wrote a wonderful paper about these things.
Okay, and this is an invariant for unoriented links, is that?
Yeah, okay. Right. And we, being young and impetuous people, said, and we don't think there's any way to introduce an orientation. We actually put it in print. And then I realized Lou Kaufman was interested in these things, and I said, gosh, we should really tell Lou about this in Chicago. So we sent him a copy of the paper, and he realized how to put in the orientation. Damn. So he created what he called his lambda polynomial. It's exactly the same sort of thing, morally speaking. But then he realized how to use the Rive to put in the orientation and come up with a two-variable polynomial, which has the same kinds of properties and is independent, distinct from the other polynomials. So once you get in the polynomial game, the question is, how many different polynomial invariants are there? Are they independent? Do they give you new information? Plus, what information do they give you? And these two, Kaufman's and the Humphrey one, I think are, for the most part, how to say it, mathematicians like to make sure they have it. So for all practical purposes, that's it. All practical purposes. You embellish these things, maybe, but we haven't had any more really brilliant ideas since then in this direction. This is why I call this the Jones era, sort of the classical era. Also, however, this paper provoked Lou to realize that he could create a new way to go after polynomials, which he called his bracket polynomial, by resolving a crossing in these two different ways. Okay, and so a simple argument shows it's sort of a planar invariant. He knew how to add the Rive in to make it a topological invariant because he'd already done it from this polynomial that Bob Brand and Ray Lickrish and I had. And so out comes this kind of recursion relationship, which if you look at it for a moment, you think, ah, God, that looks a lot like the Jones polynomial, and by golly, it is. You just take this change of variables. So here, with an entirely new direction, there were representation theory ways of going at knot polynomials through the braid group and representations of the braid group. There were these sort of double induction on the number crossings and the unknotting number kinds of ways. This was different. This was gave rise to a kind of resolution of a knot diagram leading to a state sum that resembled very much what goes on in statistical mechanics. And that was a rather different and very powerful new approach to things, where there were sort of ties to a new area of mathematical or physical structure that could be exploited. And so I'm going to stop. I always wonder, what's the next slide? I believe I'm going to stop this direction at this point and sort of pass that baton on to Radmila, who talked about what happened then in the wake of this. And I think I'm moving to biology. Yes. So also, 1984 was a powerful year for me and for many of us for a number of reasons. So first it was Jones and then Humphrey and all this other stuff going on. But also, 1984, I went to MSRI, where I met Vaughn and learned about everybody else doing this stuff. I also met Nick Cozzarelli. And Nick was a professor of biology at Berkeley, and in his lab, they were studying, trying to analyze enzyme mechanisms using knots. So basically, they would create, as biologists can do, rings of DNA where they can control the actual sequences, what was going on there, and they knew something about the enzymes and could sort of make up a soup of these things and let their enzymes act and then analyze them and try to figure out from the resulting configurations of DNA what they had. The key part here that was occurring in 1984, 83, was the capacity to get electron micrographs of knotted DNA. Okay, the resolution was good enough now, so if you thickened your DNA by adding a protein, it's sort of like an onion ring sort of thing. You sort of dip it in a protein, make it a little bit fatter. You can get pictures like this, and then try to determine what is the knotting that occurs, and from that, deduce something about the structure of this. So that meant that biologists were, at least in this area, interested in talking with mathematicians, in particular topologists, for like the first time. And so that's how I spent lots of time in Nick's lab, talking with him and his postdocs and graduate students about knots and these mechanisms, and along with a lot of my friends, DeWitt Sumners, Jim White at UCLA, Lou Kaufman, and I also met the fellow who produced these images, Andrei Stasiak, who's at Lausanne, and he's become a long time, collaborator and friend. So this was also a very catalytic kind of year, where I started becoming aware of and becoming interested in things in biology, and that led to then what I want to talk about now. Yes, I'm doing very well. So this is the sort of more recent stuff. So I became interested in knots that arose in biology, in particular in protein structures. And I want to tell you a little bit about the mathematics, the methods that we use, and about some results, some very recent results. So the first thing is, I came to the realization that I needed to change my view of knot theory. That topologists will like to close up the ends and capture the knotting. But in fact, in nature, in polymers and macromolecules and in protein structures, that just doesn't happen. And so I changed my orientation a little bit, or quite a bit, to say, okay, I'm going to look at knots like this. And I'm going to look at their complexity and their sort of, how to say it, their size. Like, this is a little trefoil. This is a big trefoil. How do I measure little and big? How do I measure the shape? Is this thing in space sort of flat? Is this thing more spherical, or is it more ellipsoidal? Things like that. Physical knot theory became, the physical aspects of knot theory became, for me, much more important. I just mentioned this because these are physicists. Actually, Smith is a physicist down at San Diego, and Raymer, I think, was an undergraduate student who wanted to do a project, and they took a bunch of string, shook them up in a barrel, and analyzed the knotting, and so you see knots with open ends. This was a rather charming experiment, I think, and one that sort of characterizes how I'm wanting to approach this. But there are some challenges here. For example, Mark Mansfield was one of the first people to propose that perhaps proteins could be knotted. And so in 1994, the state of the art was basically encapsulated by this quote: "Nevertheless, to paraphrase Justice Stuart Potter of the U.S. Supreme Court, we may not be able to define a knot in an open path." So, okay, that's like waving a red flag in front of a mathematician. "But we know one when we see one. Since protein contours are not closed paths, it is only in the subjective sense of a reasonable person," I don't think I know many of those, "test that we can address the existence of knots in proteins." And I basically thought to myself, damn, this is an opportunity. Because, in fact, at this time, we're first starting to see knots in protein structures. And the way in which they were recognized, I felt, was not the best we could do. The idea was, going back to the 1970s with Sam Edwards and others, to analyze, you guys?
We just for the, what the actual context of the quote was originally.
Oh, of the Mansfield?
Yeah. One?
You can find it if you Google Mansfield. It was probably in a letter to Nature or something like that, or something like that. Just a little letter of communication.
The Supreme Court comment.
Pornography. Right. You physicists don't get out in the world much, I know. Oh, you knew, but you wondered if other people did. Yeah.
Look, wait, so you got the reference a little bit. That's Potter Stewart.
Potter Stewart. Stewart Potter. Oh, Stewart. Potter Stewart. I have it inverted.
It's Stewart also.
I see. Yeah, it was about pornography. I got that part right. I have a big problem with dyslexia. And so, anyway, among other things.
So you want merosymmetric knots.
Yes. Yeah. So anyway, that was the context. So the proposal was basically going back to this, the 70s, and rediscovered by people along the way. Willie Taylor, for example, applied it in 2002 proteins. You hold the ends fixed, and then you try to shrink it shorten it by using things that were sort of the underlying mathematics that Rademeister uses to describe Rademeister moves. You try to make them shorter. The problem with the algorithms were that they were dependent upon how you implemented them. And so I was interested in the knots and proteins that Taylor was doing, but I was anxious about his method. And so I talked Akash Dobe and Andrei Stasiak into working with me on this a bit. And I created this example which says, well, it does depend. If you do it one way, you get one answer, you get a truffle. You do it the other way, you get an unknot in this specific case. So that led us to propose another way. Also very popular was to take these two ends and sort of close them up in some way, a single way. And that was fragile because if you started deforming things, you would get different answers, whereas any reasonable person would say it's the same knot. So, okay, we didn't like that. So my idea was close them up in every possible way and see what you get. Okay, so here's the idea. There's a little knotted, a little segment of something in space. And now here is meant to be a huge sphere, 100 kilometers. And I take a point on that sphere and I close up the beginning and the end to that point. Now I get myself a closed knot. Okay, I'm still half traditional. I can check the knot type of that. And I say, okay, now let's look on the sphere, this big sphere, and look color. What happens by the knot type. So this one color would be one knot type, another color would be another knot type, and so on. Spheres being compact, this being a locally constant function, a position on the sphere, I know I can then talk about basically the area or the proportion of the sphere associated with any knot type. So I can now get a fraction of the time of the closure is giving me a certain knot type. And so I say, well, if it's, you know, like 70% of the time, if it's a trefoil, let's call it a trefoil. And if only, you know, 35% of the time it's an elephant, well, it's really a trefoil that sometimes looks from that perspective like an elephant. Okay? So we're going to designate this, it's like my dad said, how to say it. If you don't fail every once in a while, you're just not trying hard enough. But, he was a businessman, but if you want to stay in business, you better be right more than half of the time. Okay, so I said, oh, I'll just use my dad's criteria. If it's a trefoil more than half of the time, we'll call it a trefoil. And the fact that it failed a few times, well, that's not a big deal for all practical purposes. And then you have to prove a theorem that for all practical purposes, you're going to get a criteria that can be implemented and will be robust. So what we did was we started employing these on random walks just to test to see how well this would work. And what we see is confirmation of a theorem that goes back to the late 80s, 1988, of DeWitt Sumners and Stu Worthington and Nick Pippinger, that as you take a random walk, if it gets long, then probability goes to one that will contain a knot or a random polygon. And so we're seeing the proportion that don't contain a knot goes to zero. The proportion that contain a trefoil goes up to what, about 70%, figure eights. And by the time you have 500 steps in your random walk, believe me, you can get some very complicated knots. And so we did this 1,000 times. And so in this direction, you see these histograms. And what we discovered was with 500 step random walks, doing these closures, for all practical purposes, we got an answer. When we're at the 50% level, where is that? Right about here, then most of the time, all except for like one or two times in 1,000, did we have cases that we couldn't decide. But for statistical purposes, because we're interested in ensemble averages, that wasn't a big deal. So we would still get good results. Also, so that was the math side. Other things, you know, the world continues to go on. And Todd Yates and his friends down at UCLA then published a paper in which they told us that there were not only knots in proteins using whatever method, but slip knots. And slip knots are, if so you can see this, I start at this sort of blue end and I come around here go around here and come down. Once I'm at this point, between here and here, I've tied a trefoil knot. What makes it a slip knot is the fact that the protein then continues to pass back up and unties that knot. So it's a slip knot in the sense that it's an unknotted configuration that contains a knot. Now, I was trying to think of ways to convince you that slip knots are really important. And first of all, Rob's no help, but those of us who have shoes and shoelaces, if you pull on your shoelace, you discover that that bow that you tied in there is really a slip knot. Slip knots have spatial consequences, have structural consequences. They're used to bundle stuff together. So, borrowed your rope here. So here you see I've got all these sort of ropes. I mean, we do this all the time. We take, you know, a bunch of, you know, we're out in the woods, we're collecting branches for our bonfire, for our campfire. We bundle them up, and so how do we, what do we tie a knot around them? Well, actually, that's a good method, but a better method is to tie a slip knot around them so that when you pull on it, right, you pull on it, it becomes unknotted. If only I could do that. Oh, damn. It was supposed to come out like that. But anyway. So slip knots give you an opportunity to do to contain something with spatial integrity and yet have a process that's going to undo that. Okay, so you can use slip knots, I claim, in order to, create, protect regions, to hold things together, and that's a direction that I really want to follow up on here.
Don't sewing machines do that?
Sewing machines also.
Right.
Crocheting, knitting, bow ties, proteins. So I'm going to show you not only these proteins, but many more. So you can also use this mathematical structure then to take a large configuration like a loop and a closed loop here and try to determine where the knot is. How big is the knot? So if you look at your average closed loop in space, is the knot that's knotted, is the average size of the knot large? Does it grow with the length sort of linearly, like half of it? Or is it sort of bounded by, you know, like 50 or something? 50 lengths in average. Well, so I looked at this with random walks again, and here is a knot. These are knots, typically trefoils, and this is sort of, excuse me, the distribution of the knotted trefoils in these random five or seven random walks. I call these ephemeral knots because, in fact, you unknot them, so they're the knotted portion of a slip knot. Their average size, you see, is much broader. You need more space to allow yourself to go in and unknot them. Okay. So slip knots are, in fact, sort of bigger spatially, so they can sort of allow these things, excuse me, to pass through them. Presence of slip knots, pretty substantial. Okay, trying to get back to running out of time here. So when you start looking for knots and slip knots in protein structures, well, here's what we do. We look at all these subsegments, and we color them according to the knot type. So here's like the C-terminus and the N-terminus. So a point down here says go from one end to the other, and we see a knot. As things get shorter, shorter is measured by going out diagonally, you see they're unknotted, because short segments typically don't contain knots. Here, however, you see a knot, but if you go longer, it's unknotted. So here would be a slip knot. And here is another slip knot that's unknotted in both directions, sort of as indicated by this picture. Okay, so this is what we're going to look at. We're going to look at protein structures and try to show you something about the complexity, the nature of knotting in them. So here's a typical one in the DH1 protein, not typical, contains a stevedore's knot. Everybody know what a stevedore is? No. Nick Stevedore was a very famous topologist. In the 1800s. No. He's a longshoreman. He's a dock worker. stevedores are dock workers. And so these knots, the 6-1 knot, is the kind of knot that dock workers used when they're tying stuff together. So that's the story. All right, okay. I started a little late. Maybe I can continue a few minutes. Okay, so here we see a slip-knotted trefoil in the midst of this 6-1 knot. You see we have a 6-1 knot down here. We have a 6-1 slip knot over here, and over here we have this 3-1. So now we're back in the, it's like the Cozzarelli regime. We get knot information, and we're going to try to deduce things about structure and function and nature of proteins. And so here's sort of a diagram that indicates this transformation.
So are these persistence diagrams?
Are they what?
Persistence diagrams.
I'm not sure. Persistence.
Well, you know, if you know they're not.
I don't know that term.
What do you mean? You know, like when you look at the birth and death of something, right? You're...
Oh, so what these are, you can imagine. So if this cell says, okay, I'm at a beginning point and an ending point, right?
Yeah.
If I allow myself to elongate in one direction, that's what happens. If I elongate in the other direction, that's what happens.
This is elongating, just following the chain.
Following the chain. In a longer segment of the sequence.
It's measuring like the birth and death of...
Yeah, it's measuring like the birth and death. If you think of the growth or the process as you start with a little sequence in there and you let it get longer this way and let it get longer that way, and as you go along, then suddenly you've gone enough around so you've created a knot.
Right.
Yeah. So that's what we're trying to indicate in these diagrams. So this is curious. So what we did was, of course, looked at the 74,223 structures, found that 398 of them were knotted, and you've got to look at everything to see this, that there were 222 that were slip-knotted. Okay, now, what can you deduce from that? Not a whole lot unless you look at them. And now, what you see are motifs, that is, repeated patterns of knotting and slip-knotting that occur in different, very large families of proteins. Things that may be related. So I'm going to talk about some examples. This one down here is a really one that we thought was really wonderful. Let's see. Here, it's hard to see at this angle, but you see the same motif here in, this is a Plasminium falciparum. Plasminium falciparum. You see this pattern here. You see the same thing in a human protein and in a yeast protein. You see exactly the same motif or signature of knotting in these. The Plasminium falciparum is associated with malaria. I had to look that up. So very curious that you see exactly the same structure in these very, very different kinds of proteins. Proteins that come from very different sources. Okay, rather inspiring. Here, similarly, another kind of example where we see roughly the same kind of structure, but the scales change a little bit. Okay, so we see not only sort of almost isomorphic structures, but we see sort of homeothetically similar structures, just a change of scale, and this is in two other proteins. These things are conserved across large families. Mm-hmm. Here's another one. And this is sort of the reason I tried to tie that slip knot here. This one you see 3-4 slip knots. This one we call the blip, 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 blip structure, sort of like a code. And you'll notice what's happening here is that this thing sort of winds back and forth, very much as I tried to do in this creation here. This is a, transmembrane protein. It's a kind of protein that goes through the membrane of a cell, sort of like a little needle thing. And one of the, looking at this, our proposal is that this slip-knotted structure in there helps stabilize the positioning and the function of these transmembrane proteins. Okay, so now we're trying to figure out why these things are preserving these structures, because we know that it's harder to form or to fold protein structures that have knots and slip knots. So from an evolutionary point of view, that should have been, should have disappeared, unless there was a very specific, very distinctive, maybe very powerful kind of evolutionary advantage that was being achieved there. Oop, I have to point it at that. There we go. So another thing we notice is that the frontiers of the knotting region, or the slip knotting region, which we've sort of labeled here by our G's and labeled on the diagrams, these are glycines, that the structures seem to be associated with the hinge or the joint parts of the protein structure as it folds, the things that are sort of more flexible structurally. So we're sort of, you know, detectives here collecting information. Well, in view of the time, I will sort of just tell you very briefly that that analysis applies to proteins. We're trying to do, so some of us, some students and I, are trying to apply these to knots. And so you can do the same kind of structure for a closed loop. Interior, right at the center, those are very short segments. Those are always unknotted. As you go out, we color by the knot type. So here's the trefoil knot. You can sort of see the three lobe structure in this sort of green wiggly thing there. Here are 817, 818, 819. You start seeing more exotic kinds of structures, which tell you something about how the knot is formed in this sort of growing, how to say, growing along the length of the configuration. Oops, wrong one.
The other picture, you had a whole different thing, so the configuration space was a simple.
Right.
Here it's an annulus.
Here it's an annulus. Well, it's actually a disc, because if you have like zero, you'd be unknotted at the middle, and then as you go out, you get longer and longer segments, and the angle where you start tells you where you started on your closed curve.
So you let them come together.
Yeah, you let them come together. And so on the outside, you always get the knot type, because this is always the entire thing. And then inside, you're seeing a sort of factorization into sort of smallest components of knotting and how they're pieced together or how they grow in order to form this knot. So I think these are sort of cool structures. But I can't prove a theorem about them yet. So it's like you've had this cool discovery, but what's the information? So David Hyde's an undergraduate here at Santa Barbara. Joshua Heinrich is an undergraduate at St. Thomas, University of St. Thomas up in St. Paul, Minnesota. And then Eric Rodden is my colleague, and Andrei Stasiak gets roped into everything because we ask him, okay, what does this mean? Is there any scientific application? And so we're all sort of partners in this conversation. So anyway, that's the end of this very long tale about my odyssey through knots from the beginning of time to last week. And does anyone know the source of this picture?
Yeah, I know.
You know?
I know the whole modification.
Pavel, do you know Piotr Piransky? Physicist. Piotr is a good friend of ours because of his historical work with Andrei, and he has a website in which many of us figure. This is one where I could have gotten a picture of Rob doing something crazy or myself.
I just know one instance where he obsessed something.
Yes, right. I decided, actually, William, to take this hat today because the other hat that I was wearing figures in Piotr's picture of me in Las Vegas at a conference we organized a number of years ago, which is, anyway, fun. Anyway, so have fun with knots. I thought it was fun to think about knots and smoke rings since this was an organizing feature of the conference. Thank you for your attention and patience with my stories. Yes, sir.
You draw diagrams in which you indicated regions of trefoil loss in basically yes or no. You introduced the threshold and,
how stable are those?
But in principle, you could. There is more information if you plot the probability of different nodes. Is there anything to be learned from this greater?
Well, sure, given that you've asked the question, I suspect the answer is yes. And we haven't looked at it in this context. I know that Akash and I and Ben Sheldon, who is another undergraduate here, looked at that, setting different thresholds. And also, when we close to the sphere, you might say, how many points do you use? 100, 1,000, 10,000, 1,000,000? And so we studied how robust our answers were, both by changing the threshold and by changing the number of points. So, for practical purposes...
The last one I would be less concerned about, because these straight lines, it's obvious in most cases by inspection that small perturbation
right.
then doesn't change.
But how many points should we sample on the sphere? I sampled them randomly. We're now sampling them using a uniform distribution, so to get sort of less, because random things aren't uniform, and we really want sort of a uniformity there. So Laura, I think, is proposing that 200 uniform points are okay. Eric, the big computer guy, he says 100 are sufficient. I was using 1,000 for a long time. So there's that thing you can play with, and it was really stable with regard to that number of choices, so that 100 seemed to be defendable. Whether or not you want to say 50% or 70%, Akash and I tested on random walks, and we found that if we were at like 70% was our threshold rather than 50, we were getting answers something like 98% of the time out of 1,000. So again, for statistical purposes, that seemed to be okay.
Yeah. So you go off in the same direction.
Right.
You can take something that's too equidistributed on the sphere, go off in pairs of directions
right.
or opposite directions. Can you try to do this
yes.
exchange of the types of
wires? So I will. The reason I chose one point is I can make colors on a two sphere, but I can't do it on a
S2 cross S2
being in four dimensions. I said, let's just stick with one point. Because then we use the equal area projection to sort of give us a good feeling for what's happening. But that is certainly a popular way of doing it. Well, you will see some differences for sure. And if you only do it a single way, you will see significant differences, but it may be like 10% of the time or something like that. So if you want to, if you worry about that 10%, then that's a fragile kind of strategy, I think. Yeah.
I have another question. With these random walks, you basically get linear sequence in knot complexity when they occur. But is this fair to all the knots? Do all the 8 crossing knots have similar chance to occur?
No. Some knots occur more often than others. So the probability distribution is not an equal probability distribution. It's highly skewed. And we don't know anything about what that probability distribution would look like, because as soon as we knew that, we would prove lots of theorems. I'll give you an example. I can prove that in every random walk, as the length goes to infinity, probability 1 equals the slipknot. Okay? I can prove that in every random walk that's knotted, with probability 1, you will see a slipknot. But I can't prove that in every random walk that is a trefoil, you will see a slipknot. Or I can't prove that in every random walk that's unknotted, with probability 1, you will see a slipknot. Those have to be true. But basically, since we don't know how to do it with a trivial knotted random walk, we don't know how to do anything of that sort. Because the proportion of unknotted random walks goes to 0 as the length goes to infinity. And so we're stuck.
But do all the proportions go to 0?
Yes.
Yeah. Is there some universal knot that is, I don't know, asymptotically?
No. Everything goes, basically every single instance of what you can imagine has to occur with probability one, and the proportion of the number of times it does occur goes to zero. Yeah. So this is, yeah. Yes, sir.
What was the answer for the scaling of the size of the knots in random walks?
So first, off lattice. Okay, ideal random walks and no excluded volume. Let's see here if I can't remember where it is. Oops, where is my computer? Where's the scaling? There's the scaling. So up to 500 off lattice. Oh, this is the proportion. I wonder. Yeah, I didn't tell you, did I? Aha, how cunning. So the truth is that I don't recall for sure, but order of magnitude. It's like the average length of a knot in a random walk seems to be asymptotically about 40, let's say. And if I have a slip knot, the ephemeral knot part, seems to be maybe 50. So in other words, those two things seem to be bounded. That's the tough conjecture. If you look at lattices, they don't seem to be bounded. And so why? Well, I think it has to be an issue of excluded volume. And I don't have an analytical argument that I can't prove that. I have some plausibility arguments, but no, no mathematical, no rigorous argument is the word I'm searching for. No rigorous argument.
But this may be an artifact of the observation that this characteristic length, which comes into unknotted probability, is orders of magnitude larger for lattice
yes.
walks than. Right. So therefore, maybe eventually you come to the same answer.
Yeah.
But on present-day computers, you are far from.
Yeah. So 500 steps off lattice, you get very, very complex knotting.
Right.
500 steps on the lattice, you get nothing, virtually nothing. You have to be out. All of them are unknotted that you observe. They're knots exist, but you don't see them.
But if you have 500 steps, is it different if the length of the step varies or?
It can be different. This data is for length one. Right. You can do lots of fun things. I've done lots of fun things like put them in a box. So here's a game that's been attributed to me. I wanted to test these ideas. Going back to, actually this started during this workshop, this NATO workshop. We make a box, and we take, with uniform density, we take points inside of a box, and we connect them up cyclically and ask about the knotting. That just goes. If you make it equilateral, it's much harder to get them in there, and then you see much more civilized kind of knotting behavior.
If you compare the shortest length of the free end of this mm-hmm. slip knot to the diameter of the tightest ball that contains the knot, that would be good in relation with the probability to unknotting?
Probability of unknotting.
I mean, you see.
I think you're asking a dynamical question.
This has to do with dynamics, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
The distance of the free end is the small.
Yeah.
So the way I would propose that knots form is they form sort of at the ends, and then they move along and get bigger, and they don't sort of form in the middle. Now, Johanna has done some simulations with DNA, which suggests that these knots form by first having sort of a loop, and then a sort of a knuckle comes through, and then it pops through like that, and suddenly you have a knot. So you start, the folding process, she proposes, is a forming a slip knot first that sort of energetically somehow that's more attractive, and then in some cases that thing will pop through creating a knot in there. And so that's sort of why knots tend to be sort of close to ends for the most part. But we do have things which they call deeply embedded knots. So that's...
Wouldn't you think that the knuckle is very low probability if you were doing dynamics, right? The knuckle is very low entropy compared to the head
finger,
of the snake,
yeah,
just coming through.
Right, but you see, proteins don't behave in random ways. That's really the problem. All of my random stuff doesn't really inform protein folding questions. Yeah.
We have a very colorful disk showing how big a knot is sort of made up of small knots.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't that depend on what version of the knot you use?
Like, yes.
You shrink it to an ideal knot.
Right. I wonder, I should have said something about that. And these are what we call, in another part of the world, we call these ideal knots, because these are maximum rope length, maximum thickness of knots.
Yes, so it wasn't a projection.
No, it wasn't. Let's see. I keep forgetting where my computer is. Yeah, so this is a approximation of one which has maximal thickness. And, I don't have any. There. So there's a projection of 820, which is supposed to have sort of maximal thickness. So it does depend. We've done some studies where we took random knots, and of course that's very, very noisy, and it's really only appropriate for adult audiences. Not even Potter Stewart would go for those. Yeah, so anyway. Yeah, so these are all rope length. So this is the optimization work comes from probably Jason Cantarella and Eric Rodden and friends, sort of. Eric and Jason and the folks down in Georgia.
Yeah. I have a high school question. What's the origin of the polynomial nature in invariants, not invariants? Why polynomials?
Have you been talking to Michael Attia?
Yes, actually.
Yeah. Well, so that's a good question. And you can answer that for the Alexander polynomial, mm-hmm. because there is a sort of natural polynomial structure associated to the universal, infinite cyclic branch cover of the complement of the knot. Maybe you sort of look at the homology branch cover, make it abelian. So it looks like a long tube, and it's cut in slices. If you read Rolfson's book, he tells you how to do this. You cut it in slices, and then as you have sort of like a building plan, namely this. If you go once around your knot by a meridian, you go like this. So the homology has a sort of a natural polynomial structure associated to how far you translate it. And that's the T in the Alexander polynomial. So it's sort of that, it's like the integers. But in these others, there's nothing comparable.
There's something sort of, I mean, in a way, if you think Schubert theorem says knots have to connect some or pre-commutative monomic, right? And knot invariants you can think of as functions to, say, the real numbers or whatever, integers, right? So take a pre-commutative monomic, real value functions, that's a polynomial ring automatically, right? So functions on knots are a polynomial ring, and so if you take a multiplicative function to something, it's got to be to polynomials, right? Well, it's the free.
So these are multiplicative underconnected sums. So there's.
Right. So and that's like just sort of the local, the global principle mm-hmm. that a lot of people in quantum topology like to think about.
Mm-hmm. So all these ingredients you say are multiplicative underconnected.
Yes.
Yeah, so that's
right.
There's nothing to do really with the simplified view of having the right master moves encoded in the Alexander and the original Alexander.
No. Yeah, there are lots of other things. Gosh, I think I've imposed on your hospitality. No. Yes? More questions?
A few words on this Ed Witten's approach to knot theory. Do you think that it could be useful for his studies?
I don't think I'm capable of answering. I don't have an opinion because at the deepest level, I don't really understand the philosophy, the approach to it, and well enough to know. So as you see, in some ways, in terms of the invariance, I'm firmly rooted in the sort of Jones you know, the last of the classical era. There are more powerful ways of doing things, answering different topological questions, that really haven't captured my, you know, attention so much.
Does it give
that I don't know about Witten.
Or is it just a different way of reinterpreting old results?
I really don't know. Yeah. But maybe Radmila does. If you pressed her hard enough, she might answer. No, she's escaped.
you know the joke about the 1990 field medals, right? Three quantum and one classical.
Yes. So, you know, the quantum stuff, this was really, in my mind, this quantum stuff came from Bob Brandt, actually. He was sort of the hole in the dike when Bob, on his little Macintosh box, suggested we should look at these because we're wondering if these are polynomials. If they're polynomials, what happens if you evaluate them? And Bob came in and he said, well, here I evaluate this at, you know, I'm not sure, some complex, you know, some fifth root of unity or something. And I can't remember exactly. And out came a bunch of numbers. And these numbers were all squares. Tell stories on ourselves. But these numbers were all squares. And Bob and I said, my God, these are all squares. How is that possible? This is really weird. This is before email. So we said, all right, we'll send a letter to Raymond, and maybe he'll have an idea about how to prove these are all squares. So we sent this letter to Raymond, and about a week and a half later, comes back a letter saying, this is the most idiotic thing I've ever heard of. Whatever you do, don't tell anybody about this. I, you know, don't want to be humiliated in front of my colleagues. I'm paraphrasing. I have the letter, but anyway, it was very much of that spirit. So Bob and I were enjoined from actually telling anybody that we'd found all these squares. Then the next day, we got another little postcard from Raymond. He said, these are all the squares of the signatures of the knots. Very curious. So we said, aha, they're the squares of something. Well, the next day we got a letter from Raymond with the proof that. And so that started us on a whole adventure of testing roots of unity and seeing which roots of unity gave us things that we could measure in classical invariance. And so we wrote lots of papers. Raymond wrote papers. We wrote papers about these. And so the focus on roots of unity and these knot polynomials, I think, started with the observation that they gave us numbers that occurred in the, what we would call the commutative theory of knots. The classical commutative theory of knots. And then things became crazy, and who knows what happened with quantum this and quantum that. And so I went back to drawing pictures. Anyway, so very fascinating about how this sort of discretization, the representation theory, and quantum stuff all evolved. It was just an amazing thing to behold. We call that the Keplerian side of our research. Right. We're just computing patterns. We're looking at numbers and looking for patterns. This is sort of the dark side of knot theory. And sometimes it pays off. It did for Kepler. You know, at least we got a few papers. But, you know. And some really interesting information. Okay, I think it's time for me to get a cup of tea or something.